Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places. Welcome to Forward Thinking.
Hey there, and welcome to Forward Thinking, the podcast that looks at the future and says, if you're down, he'll pick you up. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And today is going to be part one of a two-part series we're doing on one of the most important life-saving technologies of the past couple centuries.
Yeah, we're talking vaccines.
Yeah.
Saving literally millions, countless lives, you could say, because there's no way of knowing one way or the other. But clearly...
Yeah, they might have all gotten better anyway.
Yeah. Probably not all of them.
Probably not.
But maybe...
Statistically speaking.
Maybe a few. But at any rate, we know that millions of people are alive today because of vaccines.
Yeah, and we wanted to cover it because it's been an interesting journey seeing how the public relationship with the science of vaccines has changed over my lifetime.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember when I was a kid, vaccines just being... being a kind of uncontroversial part of medicine. As far as I knew, maybe I wasn't aware of whatever controversies may have existed then.
Right.
I think they were relatively uncontroversial for the entire span of their existence up until...
Like the 90s?
Yeah.
Unless you count like the first few decades of vaccination, in which case there was some contention, but...
Well, that's because they didn't work then.
Once they were established from that point forward, yeah, people really didn't have a whole lot of contentious things to say until the 90s, but we'll go into that probably more in part two.
Yeah, but one of the things that's interesting to look at from our perspective on vaccines is that I think... The public has sort of lost track of the progress of vaccines and
right.
future projections about vaccines because we live in a climate now where news stories about vaccines tend to be about the political controversy, people who, you know, activist groups who are opposed to vaccines for some reason, instead of about what new things vaccines could do in a medical sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we've got a lot to say about vaccines. And in this episode, we're really going to be looking, it's almost like it's a stuff you miss in history class episode instead of forward thinking episode.
Yeah, yeah. We're talking about the future of vaccines, and by the future, we mean the past.
Right.
In part one.
In part one, yeah. In part two, we're going to go into some of the new techniques that are being developed and some of the new ways that this sort of technology is going to continue to change our lives. And in this first episode, we'd like to clear up a little bit of the confusion, perhaps, about what vaccines are, how they work, how they have worked, and what they are doing for us right now.
Yeah, exactly. So we have to have a basic understanding to work from. So at the very beginning, if you want to take a super bird's eye view, vaccines essentially are a method of teaching our immune systems how to respond to specific pathogens, specific disease-carrying microbes.
Yeah, I tend to think about vaccines sort of at two levels of resolution.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is the specific sense in which most of the time, especially with infectious diseases, there it's referring to using a damaged or killed version of that disease in order to teach your body's immune system how to respond to it.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's also a broader sense of looking at the concept of vaccination as essentially a preventative measure in medicine that gives you resistance or immunity to a condition or disease before you get it.
Yes.
Oh,
so
right,
it's a preventative.
And inoculation.
It's pre-therapy.
Right. Mm-hmm. And also it's not just for the individual, right? You know, talking about vaccination, this is really for the good of large groups of people because often we're talking about diseases that can be contagious. Now, not all diseases that you would get vaccinations for are contagious,
mm-hmm.
but several of them are. And you would like to have a vaccinated population to prevent that kind of outbreak at reaching an epidemic, you know, proportion, if possible. And just to be clear, when I'm saying diseases that aren't contagious, I'm talking about human-to-human contagion, right? Some diseases you catch from other sources, like malaria is spread through mosquito bites,
mm-hmm.
but not through human-to-human contact.
Mm-hmm. And we don't have a vaccine for malaria.
Yes, spoiler alert for part two. But yes, exactly. We do not yet have a vaccine for malaria. And there's very good reasons why we have not yet developed one. We'll talk about that in part two.
But we do have one for shingles.
Yes. Shingles being the same actual virus that causes chickenpox, but the shingles variant is not human-to-human contagious. If I were to develop shingles, I would not be able to pass it on to my coworkers here. I would just be in a lot of discomfort. So there are different types of diseases, and both bacterial and viral diseases are represented among the vaccinations that we can get.
Yeah.
It's not just one or the other. You know, we talk about antibiotics. That's typically something you would use for a bacterial infection, but not
only
a viral one.
Something you can use for a bacterial infection, right?
So in this case, vaccines could be used for either. Mm-hmm. And when in the case of malaria, that's parasitic. But again, we'll talk about that more in part two. So you might think, all right, well, how far back does this idea date?
Well, I'd imagine that before we had vaccines, somebody had to observe that for some diseases, most people only got them once.
And in fact, that did happen. And one of the earliest records we have dates back to 429 BCE. And that was when a Greek historian whose name I am going to spell and then attempt to say.
It's Thucydides.
Thucydides? Is that it?
Yeah.
I've never ever heard it before.
Thucydides? Come on. He's probably talking about smallpox in Athens, right?
Look, I was a Shakespearean scholar. I had little Latin and less Greek. So Thucydides then. At any rate, Thucydides observed in 429 BCE that people who were exposed to smallpox and recovered did not seem to get it again, whether they were around lots of people who had smallpox or not. And it was this idea that kind of eventually evolved. And what's interesting is that it evolved in different places around the world, more or less at around the same time. We don't have a record of it originating in one part of the world and then spreading, like the knowledge spreading of how to make a practical application of this knowledge. It may very well be that it independently was developed in various areas around the world, more or less in the same time frame.
But there do seem to be ancient civilizations that figured out how to make use of this observation.
Yes.
Not just kind of, hey, that's an interesting fact. You can only get smallpox once, but thinking that maybe if we, you know, kind of scrape off somebody's smallpox scabs and jam them up your nose, that might help you.
Similar to that, not quite that level, but yes. So
not
this,
far off.
This is the predecessor to vaccination that is called variolation, or generally called variolation. There are some other names like engrafting that I'll talk about later. There, it's essentially the same thing.
Yeah, I've read this showed up in like China and India.
Yeah, and Africa.
Yeah.
Yeah, it happened to show up in a lot of different places all around. Again, the same general time frame. But variolation involves pretty much what you were talking about. You would take someone who has not yet been infected by a disease like smallpox, and you would end up scratching their skin and then introducing some infected material, usually scabs or possibly pus, from someone who already had contracted a weakened version of smallpox. Someone who had a mild case.
Someone, who was surviving.
Yeah.
Who had it but was doing okay.
Yeah, someone.
But had it enough to have some scabs.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's a basic symptom of smallpox.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's not like, oh, well, they've got smallpox, but don't worry, they have the non-scabby kind. It was, at any rate, it was taken from people who had the mild cases because the thought was, well, it's more likely to be less deadly than the people who had really, debilitating and often fatal cases of smallpox.
Mm-hmm.
So then they would expose the cut
on the
healthy person to this infected material, essentially rubbing the infected material, sometimes using a lancet to introduce infected material in underneath the skin, essentially injecting it into the bloodstream of the uninfected person.
Hot.
The uninfected person then would become an infected person. This was the process of going from uninfected to totally infected, but it would normally result in another mild case. And more often than not, certainly more often than someone catching the disease naturally through person-to-person contact or whatever, would recover. And so then once they recovered,
they would never get it again.
Yeah, no matter how powerful the strain was, They wouldn't get that particular disease again, specifically smallpox. The Chinese were regularly performing variolation treatments by 1000 AD, and this spread probably outward from these individual communities, not necessarily from from east to west, although that did eventually happen, but much, much later. So the Chinese physicians, what they would typically do is drain lymph from a patient who had a mild case of this disease and put that in a bottle. And the lymph would dry out, and they would usually wait a couple of weeks before they would use it. And this actually had the effect of either killing or rendering inert most of the virus inside that sample, which is a basic idea that's used in vaccines today, is using either attenuated or dead versions of the pathogen. And just so happens that they were doing it, and it worked. It was an effective treatment.
Mm-hmm. Bully for them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we fast forward to the early 1700s, that was when inoculation, this idea of introducing infected material in a healthy person to prevent them from catching something later.
So you say early 1700s. That sounds like we're not to Jenner yet.
No, right? We're not to Jenner yet. There was a lady by the name of – a lady as in a peer by the name Lady Mary Wortley Montague.
Is lady on the same level as what, lord?
Yes. Yes.
Is that a level or is that just a general?
It's a peerage. It's part of the peerage. Okay. So she was the wife of a British ambassador to Turkey and observed while in Turkey this practice of variolation. She brought it back to England. She called the practice engrafting, and she had a very personal reason for practicing this. Her brother had died from smallpox, and she herself had caught smallpox, survived, but she was terribly scarred by it.
Yeah.
She was someone who had been renowned for her beauty in her youth, and she was determined to make certain that her children did not suffer the same fate as her brother or herself, and so she used this approach. In this version, you would take pus from a blister that was formed on if someone who had smallpox had developed, and preferably a mild case of it, and then introduce it into the bloodstream of an uninfected person using a lancet. So it, again, ended up kind of catching on. I mean, it wasn't infectious or anything, but it did catch on in England and was, over time, a pretty popular way of treating people so that they would not catch smallpox. But it came with some slight drawbacks.
Yeah, as you may be able to imagine, anyone who heard us describe this process and immediately went, that's a really good way to catch lots of other diseases from somebody.
And in fact, it was a good way to catch your other. So if the person who is suffering from a mild case of smallpox also happened to be suffering from something like syphilis or tuberculosis, then there was a strong possibility you would pass
rubbing
that
their bodily
on.
Tissue into your bodily tissue.
Yeah.
Hey, that just sounds like even more vaccines, right? Probably didn't work that
didn't
way.
Work
did
that
it?
Way for tuberculosis or syphilis. No. Nope. Not all diseases are ones that you can use this particular approach to become immune to those diseases.
Well, yeah, and it wouldn't follow that if you had a particularly weak version of smallpox that your versions of those other diseases would be weak strains as well.
That's right. Also true. So, this was an issue. Now we skip ahead to 1796, and that's where we get to Edward Jenner, who is often credited as being the person who, quote-unquote, discovered vaccines. It's a little bit of a misnomer, a little bit of misinformation, but
usually anytime you say that a single person discovered a thing, it's sort of ignoring the hundreds of years of scientific history that backed their discovery.
I think the best we can say is that Jenner was the first to really apply the scientific method
to
testing a hypothesis to prove the underlying foundation was sound.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong. Like, he did amazing work. Like,
sure.
Especially considering that it was 1796, y'all.
Yeah, and he threw in his personal, fortune is probably being too grand a word. He put a lot of his time and money into this to the point where he was you know, not doing so great in as far financially speaking while he was working on this, but he believed in it wholeheartedly, so he continued to pursue it. He had been inoculated against smallpox when he was a kid using the variolation technique.
Yeah, but so there is a distinction to make with Jenner's technique versus the variolation technique, right?
Yes.
Which is the variolation technique says, let's take a weak version of smallpox and give it to you and hope it doesn't kill you or make you really sick and,
yeah.
and you'll become immune. Jenner found a sort of runaround this, right? He was like, well, what if we took a similar disease that doesn't really hurt humans?
Yeah, I mean, cowpox does create some pretty nasty pustules, but it tends to – usually it doesn't last that long, and it's rarely serious. It's kind of along the lines of like a chickenpox for someone who's young,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, obviously, as you get older, if you have never had chickenpox, it can be a more serious health hazard. But yeah, he had heard these tales about dairy maids who had suffered cowpox, but then never ever suffering from smallpox, even if they were exposed to it. And so he started to form this hypothesis that perhaps whatever caused cowpox was similar enough to smallpox that if you were to expose someone to it in this approach, they would then be immune to smallpox as well, which
yeah.
would be incredibly helpful, right? So he ended up taking infected material from a woman named Sarah Nelms, who was a dairy maid who was suffering cowpox, and ended up introducing it into the bloodstream of a young boy named James Phipps, and then later used the variolation technique to introduce smallpox to the boy's blood, and he was completely unaffected. He didn't get sick. So in other words, it was taking the variolation approach, like still trying to safely introduce a mild case of smallpox to the boy to see mm-hmm. if, in fact, he would have the symptoms, because often people would have symptoms for a short while, recover, and then they'd be immune. The boy never even developed symptoms,
mm-hmm.
thus showing that, oh, this cowpox approach is working.
Now, did the boy know what was going on here?
Yeah, well, this is a little bit less controlled than
well, either way, variolation would have been the method to sure. inoculate him against smallpox.
Yeah.
So it turned out that, you know, even if the cowpox thing hadn't worked, this was the accepted way to inoculate someone against smallpox.
Yeah.
Probably still a little ethically questionable today, but you know.
But your point is that the entire past is ethically questionable today.
Pretty
yeah,
much,
totally, yeah.
yeah. And so, you know, keep in mind, Jenner himself, he was not just a physician, not like a country doctor or anything. He had actually studied under some of the most famous surgeons in England at the time, and had even studied other fields of science, including biology. He had helped classify species that were brought back by Captain Cook after Cook's first voyage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so he was very much involved in the scientific community, and he wrote up a paper about how he used cowpox to inoculate against smallpox and ended up submitting it to the Royal Society, but they rejected the paper. They did not think that it was worthy of publication. And so he would end up self-publishing a booklet, something that I can completely
– a tradition still kept alive today.
Exactly. And
I'll show you.
His booklet had a catchy title. It was An Inquiry into the Causes and Effects of Variole Vaccinae, a disease discovered in some of the western counties of England, particularly Gloucestershire, and known by the name of cowpox.
That just rolls right off the tongue, doesn't
it? It does.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm putting this together in my brain right now, and I've never realized it before. Spanish for cow is vaca.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Probably connecting to Latin, vaca yeah. meaning cow, meaning the word vaccine comes from the word for cow.
Yeah, cowpox is uh-huh. in Latin is vaccinia. So he named the process vaccination. So vaccination refers specifically to using cowpox to protect against smallpox, but has been since broadly applied to this procedure for all sorts of different diseases. But yes, originally it all had to do with cowpox and smallpox, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Mind detonated. Yes.
I tried to throw in at least one little cool truth nugget that's going to really get you, you know, right in the thinking parts. That was my goal. At any rate, so Jenner faced a little bit of opposition to his approach because obviously anytime you come up with a different method of doing something than the standard method, there's inertia to overcome, right? But other physicians soon began to employ this vaccination technique, and by 1800, the practice had spread from UK to Europe and even to America. Thomas Jefferson himself became an advocate for vaccinations after Professor Benjamin Waterhouse of Harvard University demonstrated its efficacy. So Waterhouse had received a sample that ultimately came from Jenner of the cowpox material that could be used for vaccinations. It got to him by way of another scientist, but that's how it got over to America. And Jenner continued to push for vaccination, often, again, at his own expense, but eventually was recognized by British Parliament for his contributions to the health and welfare of the nation. And they ultimately awarded him with about £30,000, which was no small sum.
Yeah, that's not a joke right now.
No, it's a healthy dose of cash right now. Uh-huh. Back then, it was an enormous sum of money.
Yeah.
And by 1840, vaccinations had completely replaced variolation in the UK. In fact, variolation had become prohibited, so you could only go forward with vaccination at that point. And again, Jenner was not the first guy to try this out. There were some other records that predate his work, but he was the first to apply the scientific method to establish that, in fact, this was a sound method of preventing disease. But this is still before we had realized that diseases are caused by germs.
Mm-hmm.
Germ theory was not a thing, which means that there was still the risk of cross-contamination, where you could still introduce something like syphilis or tuberculosis in this process. So
just because people weren't sterilizing equipment essentially.
Yeah.
It wasn't until like the 1850s that germ theory really caught on, like really, really took hold.
Yeah.
Which is so crazy to me, thinking that that's...
That it was that late?
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, and I mean, you can read accounts in the Civil War of doctors who just didn't take to that whole idea of washing up between patients.
Yeah.
I mean,
why bother? You're just going to get your hands bloody again.
Yeah. But at any rate, you know, this is still was quite an issue here. But we also had debates that raged on other elements of vaccinations, and they went on well after the 1800s. So, for example, there was the debate about the merits of a live culture of whatever the pathogen is, whether it's viral or bacterial, versus a dead sample, a dead or inactive sample. And depending upon the vaccination, that actually does make a big difference.
Yeah.
But a big debate that was right on this very very subject was between Jonas Salk, who was the man who essentially created the polio vaccine that all but wiped out polio, although there's still some parts of the world where polio is still very much a problem, and another physician by the name of Albert Sabin, who argued for a live polio vaccine as opposed to a dead polio vaccine. Salk went out on that one, by the way. So at any rate, so that's a history. But that doesn't tell us exactly what is happening in our immune systems when we encounter one of these pathogens, whether it's from a vaccine or some other source, like if we're actually catching a disease. So in order to understand how vaccines work, we kind of have to look into the immune system of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
So to understand how our immune system works, I've got a cast of characters that we need to familiarize ourselves with. The dramatis personae, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
Of are they
immunodrama?
The cast of characters from Inner Space or The Fantastic Voyage?
Does not have Inner Space. I say I was Martin Short, right?
Which is which? They're both tiny people going in the body, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Inner Space was the comedy. But at any rate, so one of the first things we have to discuss that are several different subtypes of white blood cells actually play an important part here. We have macrophages. You guys know what macrophage means, right?
It means big eater.
Yes. Macro being big and phage being to eat. So these are cells that quote-unquote eat. other cells. They consume other cells, or other material. It doesn't necessarily mean another cell. So they eat things like microbes, like foreign microbes that come into the bloodstream. But they also eat other stuff like just detritus, you know, the garbage that accumulates in our bodies. If we didn't have these, we would, our blood would get pretty toxic pretty fast.
Yeah.
Then we have, the idea of antigens. When a macrophage eats, a microbe, it leaves behind, it saves a special part of that microbe called the antigen. They're actually molecular markers that are in
Little like proteins, yeah.
Yeah. It's essentially kind of like an identifying badge that says this is what this thing is. And antigens are what alert the immune system that a potentially harmful foreign being is present in the body. So this is what sets off the red alert inside of your body when your immune system starts to really kick in and you start feeling sick. This is what is going on. It's identified that there's something hinky going down.
Yeah.
So antigens are pretty interesting. When the macrophage eats a microbe, it saves that antigen, which helps your immune system recognize future infections from that same pathogen.
It's right. It's the body's equivalent of the wall where you put up the do not accept checks from this person.
Yeah, exactly. And I can't overstate how completely rad this process is. And that's the like official scientific term is rad. Because the cells in your immune system make these antigens part of their own genetic code and then use intracellular communication to spread word about that antigen. It's really beautiful. So let's talk about it.
Yeah. So now we've got some other white blood cell types we need to talk about. Lymphocytes. This is also part of the immune system, obviously. And within lymphocytes, we have two broad categories of cells, T cells and B cells. T cells are thymus cells, and they can run either offense or defense. So they're the Iron Man players in the immune system, right? They can switch off. Actually, technically, you've got two different types. But in the offense mode, what they focus on are human cells that have been infected by some sort of pathogen. A lot of pathogens are essentially invading human cells, overtaking the molecular machinery inside the cell.
For their own dark purposes.
Right. Usually to generate more of themselves.
Right.
Especially in the case of viruses.
Viruses, yeah.
Yeah. So it's all about, hey, let's use the body's machinery against itself and make more of us, y'all. And so that's what tends to happen. So T cells, they wage chemical warfare on your body's infected cells. So they're cells that originally belonged to you, but now have been compromised by the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's time to carpet bomb.
Yeah, it's to eliminate with extreme prejudice.
Yes.
And the idea being that if you can kill the host cell, then the pathogen will not be able to multiply, and you can get the upper hand on an infection. Defensively, T cells secrete chemical signals that alert the other elements of the immune system to the presence of a harmful microbe, and this is called cell-mediated immune response. And then you have the B cells. B cells are responsible for making antibodies. Now, antibodies are molecular weapons that lock onto antigens on microbes. So you can think of it like lock and key or a jigsaw puzzle where a particular antibody will fit snugly against a particular antigen, which means that not every antibody works on every antigen, right? If a disease, if you come in contact with a specific disease and your body has not ever encountered that before, the antibodies it produces won't fit that disease. Not initially.
Yeah, yeah. These cells are running around going like, oh, I'm trying to help, and nothing is working.
Yeah, or it's kind of like you're going through all of your keys, and none of your keys are fitting the lock on your front door.
Mm-hmm.
It's that kind of thing. And like without that compatibility, you can't actually have the immune system kick in. Now, when it does work, essentially it kind of gloms on there and renders the microbe inert, unable to harm any of the cells. So when a microbe enters your body, the macrophages are on the case. They begin to attack microbes. They hang out all over the body, the macrophages. Mm-hmm. They're pretty much localized to whatever area they are already in. And then they also send out the alert to T cells, which start, they kind of gravitate toward the lymph nodes. But T cells will come into play and really get the word out to say to the immune system, hey, here's what's going on and here's how we need to respond. Helper T cells then emit the chemical signals that alert the immune system and B cells that produce antibodies that are compatible with that microbe's antigen divide into large plasma cells. Those mass produce the appropriate antibodies that bind with the antigens, kind of gumming everything up, and it renders the antigen, or the microbe rather, thank you, from being able to infect a cell. And that's called humoral immune response or antibody response.
But it ain't no joke.
No, it's not humorous. It's just humoral. So then the killer T cells target all the cells that have already been compromised.
Mm-hmm.
This is part of why you feel so bad when you're sick, apart from the symptoms that are specific to whatever pathogen you've been exposed to. And when your body's...
Though I think it is sort of a general principle that a lot of the reasons you feel bad when you're sick are immune responses rather than the disease itself.
A lot of it is because, yeah, your body will, you know, do several things in order to fight off diseases, and not all of them make you feel hunky-dory. In fact, most of them don't.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But it's important because without that process, then you would be much more vulnerable to these pathogens. So then once your T...
You don't want a pacifist immune system.
No. You definitely want a good...
Like Klingon immune system.
Exactly. Yeah. Good offense is the best defense.
Yeah.
When your body's T and B cells are able to render inert microbes faster than the microbes can reproduce, that means you're beating the infection.
Mm-hmm.
You're winning in that war. But that can take some time, right? A particularly virulent pathogen might be able to replicate itself very quickly. And so, you know, the initial stages might be pretty touch and go depending upon the type of disease. Now, once your body fights off the disease, some of the T cells and B cells convert into memory cells, which retain this information about the disease and can rapidly produce the appropriate antibodies, which is why it's easier for you to fight off or even entirely resist future infections from the same strain. But there's a big caveat here. Strains can sometimes mutate. Some mutate much more readily than others.
Right.
Influenza being a big one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when it mutates enough, it's essentially like putting on a disguise, and the antibodies don't recognize it anymore, and you have to go through the whole process all over again. So some diseases mutate so rapidly that, like a common cold, for example.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's why you can get the cold like four or five times in a row.
Yeah.
Just because it's a different version.
Yeah.
Your body is completely unprepared to deal with this new version.
That's why we can't vaccinate against it. I mean, there's hope that because often there's a little bit of the protein chain that remains the same from mutation to mutation, that maybe one day we'll take advantage of that, but we'll talk about more of that stuff in part two.
Yes.
So with a vaccine, you know, we've talked about that's the immune response to a disease.
Yes, yes. So that is how – all of that is how your immune system works.
Yeah. Vaccines mimic an infection, mm-hmm. right? It's a purposeful introduction of a pathogenic material.
Essentially, they give your body a practice round.
Yeah. So you introduce a weakened or dead strain of some sort of pathogen into a patient's bloodstream, which kicks the immune system into gear. It responds just as it would with any other kind of infection. And the result is, once that has run its course, your body is now able to produce the proper antibodies for that particular antigen. Eventually.
It doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes a few weeks to build up this response.
Right. So if you've ever said, I got a flu shot, and then like a week and a half later I had the flu, that flu shot gave me the flu. Probably not. In fact, almost definitely not. But the problem is that when you get that vaccination, because it takes time for your body to produce the appropriate antibodies in quantities that can make you immune,
mm-hmm.
You're still vulnerable, so you could still catch the flu from your buddy who happens to already have it.
So lesson here is that if you get the flu shot, don't go out and start licking doorknobs in the house of someone who has the flu.
Right. Yeah. I always.
maybe don't lick people's doorknobs anyway, because that's
just
creepy.
Say, I got a stretch of time in the year that I have a strict no doorknob licking policy, and outside of that, it's, you know, flexible rules.
Sure.
Yeah.
But you still want to participate in your influenza cuddle puddles. And, you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, no. so just be careful for a few weeks after you get a vaccine is all we're saying.
Right. Yeah, and this is also why, like, if you're going to travel, you want to make sure you schedule the vaccinations for what, you know, if you're going to travel someplace that has particular diseases prevalent in that area, you want to schedule your vaccinations well ahead of time before mm-hmm. you actually, you know, not the day before you get on the plane. That might not be a great idea.
Okay, so earlier you mentioned that there are lots of different types of diseases that we can vaccinate against.
Yes.
So it seems logical to assume that there are lots of different types of vaccines to deal with the different types of diseases.
There are, in fact, lots of different types of vaccines to deal with different diseases. And some of them, again, it's one of those things where through very careful experimentation, we were able to determine which version works best for any particular pathogen. And some of these also can be used in conjunction with one another, depending upon how you're trying, you know, what diseases you're trying to prevent.
Yeah. Now, I've always wondered why they can't just inject some of that antibacterial soap or Listerine into you when you're getting sick.
Do you also wonder why that you can't just drink antifreeze when it gets cold?
Yeah, that's a good question, too.
Toxicity is still a thing, Joe. Toxicity is something that we can't just ignore.
Okay, well, you can't do that. We got to go with this okay. thing we've talked about earlier where they put some of these things that are going to harm you in your body for a practice round.
Yeah.
Now, they might be alive or they might be dead, right?
Yeah, so your first kind subtype of vaccine would be live attenuated vaccines.
Attenuated meaning weakened.
Exactly. And this would have a live virus or some weakened strain of bacteria, depending upon what type of vaccine you're talking about, that you would then introduce to a patient before, you know, to
an uninfected person.
Yes. That's a better way of putting it than patient.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess you're technically a patient as soon as you walk through the door, but uninfected person is much more accurate.
But this sounds like it depends on the fact that you do have a fully functioning immune system, right?
Yeah, you don't want to give the sort of treatment to someone who has a compromised immune system
mm-hmm.
because it will mean that there's still the possibility the virus could or bacterial infection could take hold and cause really severe medical complications.
Yeah. Because it depends, this system depends upon all of your immune cells being up and ready to go.
Yep. Yeah. Because otherwise you can't develop the immunity. And in fact, I should say most or at least several vaccines require multiple doses over time in order for you to actually get to the level of immunity. Many of them, like a one shot, is not enough to have lifelong immunity. Some of them there are.
Yeah, some pathogens are too virulent to risk exposing that much of the pathogen at a single time.
Very good point. Yeah, yeah, exactly. And some are so virulent that you can't go with the live attenuated vaccine approach.
And in that case, you can use
inactivated vaccines, which sound like the vaccine itself is inactive. That's not what it means. Inactivated vaccines use dead or inactivated viruses or bacteria. Then there's toxoid vaccines, which sounds like it comes from trauma films, but doesn't. Toxoid vaccines are used to treat bacterial diseases that produce toxins. So the vaccines themselves contain a weakened version of those toxins, and those are called toxoids. So when the body's immune system encounters the toxoids, it learns how to fight off the actual toxins. It's kind of like building up an immunity to Iocane powder over time.
Okay.
So that way when Vizzini comes to you and gives you a mind game, you can choose whichever vial you want. Yeah,
yeah,
it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you can put the syphilis in both cups.
That's right. Then you have subunit vaccines. This is where a vaccine is sublet to another vaccine. Actually, no, that's not true. Subunit vaccines contain just bits of a virus or bacteria. It doesn't need to have an entire
organism.
Yeah. Or virus is a little complicated.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, I said that and then thought, okay, yeah, it doesn't need to have an entire microbe.
I mean, virus is such a tricky thing, man. We could do a full, in fact, that we have talked about viruses a lot in this podcast. They're fascinating. But yes, you need to have some part of the microbe, but you don't need the whole thing. By limiting that pathogenic material to just the bits you need for the body to build up an immunity, you reduce the possibility of really severe side effects. You're probably still going to have some because it's your immune system kicking in. And again, like we've said before, a lot of your symptoms are really your immune system reacting, not necessarily the pathogen itself. Then you have conjugate vaccines. That's right. These are vaccines that have this is weird, right? Conjugate vaccines are all about kind of fooling your immune system into fighting the pathogen you want them to fight. You use this to protect against bacteria that have antigens that are coated by something called polysaccharides. This is like a sugar-like coating. Mm-hmm. So the sugar-like coating on the antigen disguises the antigen. Well, so your immune system doesn't see it.
So that when one of your T cells bumps up against one of these invading cells and goes like, hey, what are you? Are you chill? Are you not chill? Right. It doesn't find any of those antigens that would say, oh, I'm not chill.
Yeah, this.
Or even I'm not, okay.
Right, exactly. Yeah, this invading microbe, it's like it has an identifying badge that's turned the other way around. Mm-hmm. And the T cell's just like, you're probably fine. And,
Move along.
Exactly. So conjugate vaccines connect polysaccharides to antigens so that the immune system recognizes that these are in fact foreign microbes that need to be fought off. It's an interesting approach, right? It's linking the idea of this particular polysaccharide represents this particular type of microbe, and it's a little more indirect than some of the other methods we're talking about, which is pretty awesome. So we're going to conclude this episode by talking about some of the diseases that people have developed vaccines for. This isn't necessarily a completely exhaustive list, but it's pretty decent sized list of diseases for which we have vaccines. Smallpox, the thing that we started talking about, that's a big one. It has been eradicated through vaccination.
People don't get smallpox anymore.
It's gone.
And now the question is, should we preserve tiny samples of it or destroy them? So, you know, we assume that it seems to be dead in the wild.
Yeah.
We've got some samples of it in labs around the world. Should those labs keep them or not? I think there are good cases to be made on both sides.
Sure. Right?
Like that keeping it could help us develop protections in case it were to ever resurge in the wild.
Yep.
But then again, on the other hand.
If you're just keeping around.
You don't want The Stand, right?
Right.
Yeah.
You don't want Stephen King's The Stand to break out.
Yeah.
Because that's a long book. No, that's not why. But anyway, also polio. We talked about that briefly. That's a viral infection that is close to being eradicated through vaccination, though there's still limited outbreaks in different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. And then here are all the here's a list of some of the vaccines we have for bacterial infections. That would include anthrax, HIV or HIB, diphtheria, meningococcal disease, like meningitis, mm-hmm. Whooping cough, also known as pertussis, pneumococcal diseases, that's the cause of bacterial pneumonia, not viral pneumonia, tetanus, and typhoid. The typhoid vaccine is not 100% effective. It does create a resistance to typhoid, but you are not guaranteed to be immune to typhoid, mm-hmm. should you get that vaccine.
Okay, that's the bacterial end. How about the viral end?
Hepatitis A and B. We have vaccines for both of those. Shingles, like we mentioned before, and chickenpox. The virus that causes shingles is also the virus that causes chickenpox. HPV, influenza, although more on that in our next episode. Measles, mumps, rotavirus, rubella, yellow fever, all of those are viral infections for which we have vaccines. So it's
a really impressive list. That's pretty cool. Yeah.
There's some big names that aren't on that list.
Yeah.
but that's amazing. And it shows that we've come a long way.
Yeah. Like go team humanity. Like these are, it's hard to imagine in this day and age, the amount of just disastrous tragedy that these diseases caused.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
like every year.
like the fact that people our age have never had to worry about smallpox. It's hard to get across how huge that is when you're talking about a disease that has been a scourge on humanity pretty much the entire history that we had civilized humans. Mm-hmm. So That's a big deal. And
especially as more and more of us live in urban centers and mm-hmm. live within easy infection range of a lot of other people.
Sure. And of course, also the population growth in places where you have other pathogenic vectors at play. Obviously, it also depends upon where you live in the sense of your access to vaccines. That's something that we'll talk about more in our second episode. But this really was all about setting that foundation, that understanding to realize, wow, vaccines are pretty awesome. And the future is going to be super interesting, fascinating, really. And we're going to talk more about that in our next episode. So I guess I'm going to have to give everyone a reminder. If you have suggestions for future episodes of Forward Thinking, or you've got questions, something that we didn't cover that maybe you would like to hear more about, send them to us. Our email address is fwthinking@howstuffworks.com. Or you can always drop us a line on Twitter or Facebook. If you search on Facebook for FW Thinking, we'll pop right up. You can leave us a message. We are FW Thinking on Twitter. You can just tweet us there. And we will talk to you again about vaccines really soon.
For more on this topic and the future of technology, visit forwardthinking.com. Brought to you by Toyota. Let's go places.